This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast on how to be wrong. I'm John Traphagen. I'm your host for today. My co-host in error, John Kagg, is not feeling too well, so he's not going to be joining us. Today, we are honored to welcome literary critic Maria Shuvalova to the show. Maria is a lecturer at the National University of Kyiv, Mohyla and the Mohyla Academy. She's a Fulbright scholar who was at the Harriman Institute at Columbia. And she is the co-founder and head of a non-governmental organization called New Ukrainian Academic Community. And she also writes for various outlets, including places like The Daily Beast. I also want to emphasize that Maria is joining us from Kyiv. And so we are going to learn a lot today about her experiences dealing with the Russian invasion. Maria, it is wonderful to have you on How to Be Wrong.
It's a pleasure to be with you today, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, I'm delighted. So I want to begin. We usually start by asking our guests to talk a bit about, you know, how they came to their profession and their general background in their work. I certainly would like to know about that, but I'd also like to ask if you could describe a bit about what life was like in Kyiv before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and then perhaps what it's like now and how that has affected you in terms of your profession.
It's a great question. So probably I will start from the background, as it explains a lot about me and Ukraine, and then I will talk about life in Kyiv. So I was born not in Kyiv. I was born in Sarny. It's 50 kilometers to Belarus border, and this region is called Polisia, because this region, it's lowlands and mixed forest. It's like a forest belt of Ukraine, very beautiful village. And you probably may have heard that 25% of world reserves of high-yielding black soil concentrated in Ukraine. And my ancestors were small farmers. So it sounds great to be a farmer on such fertile land. But my grandparents was born right on the middle of Holodomor. It's also known as a terror famine or great famine. It's a man-made famine in Soviet Ukraine that began in 1932 and lasted till 1933 and killed millions of Ukrainians. Like my lovely friend Daria Matingly, she's Ukrainian historian specializing in Holodomor, and she holds PhD from Cambridge. She wrote an article for a broader audience about Holodomor. So it was an article for CNN. So I won't explain all about that. But she says that Ukraine was a rural country on the eve of collectivization. But the resistance to the state takeover of private property was really high and higher than anyone else in the Union. So Ukrainians, as always, don't like when someone is trying to rule them. And Ukrainian peasants never supported Bolsheviki. And they don't, well, were in love with collectivization policy, and it provoked huge resistance. So in 1930s, security services reported to Soviet leaders Joseph Stalin that Ukrainian peasants expelled authorities from many districts, and that spelled danger for the state. So repression followed, and many Ukrainian peasants were killed or sent to Siberia. And at the same time, Ukrainian intelligentsia was shaking off Russian imperial embrace in culture. So that's very turbulent time. And on the personal level, it also meant a lot for me, because my grandparents was born right on the middle of the famine, and my grandparents and my parents were used as a free labor. They were forced to work, they was not paid, and they even was not allowed to keep the stuff they were producing on their own garden. And like generations of my ancestors didn't have a chance to accumulate goods or capital or something like that. So my childhood was very poor. But independence dramatically changed everything. My mom has 9 brothers and 1 sister. And 1 brother established business after Ukraine proclaimed independence, and it went well. And all my family became employed, and we stopped living on the breadline. And we became middle class. And it was when I was in the 5th grade. So then my family moved to Kyiv. And I was so envious for education. I and my sister, we learned a few languages. And I did Fulbright in Columbia University. My sister, who is 4 years younger than me, was accepted to Paris Academy of Art, where she is doing monumental painting. And honestly, I picked up my career and started doing PhD only because it was completely impossible for my ancestors. And it's the first time in the history of my family we're middle class. And I and my sister became the first generation who get access to higher education. And we also were the first generation of Ukrainians that was not affected by war, famine, or Russian aggression. But in 2014, everything started again. Like famine was again used as a tool to oppress and to break the resistance. Part of my family now is living under occupation, where they cannot speak their language. Their property is taken out, and there is tanks on the street and tracks with radio that is playing Soviet songs like Lenin is young again. So from such nice and bright and promising young years of my life, I got back to the life my ancestors had. So that's my background. It explained a lot about Ukrainian resistance and other things, except why I am still so optimistic. I don't know how to explain that.
So you're optimistic.
Yeah, I can't explain why, but I'm always optimistic.
Well, that's good. So what are things, you know, now? What is Kyiv like right now?
I'll be very honest with you. Kyiv is not the most convenient city to live in terms of infrastructure, air quality, or inclusion. And the city is all constantly worrying and struggling. But Honestly, it's the best place to be when you are young and to learn the most important things that shape you, like what civil society is, what cooperation is. And for me, Kyiv was always a city of agency. All the most massive, peaceful protests were here. I missed so much classes in my middle school because I was going to Orange Revolution with my parents. I missed like so much lessons on my university because I was going to the Revolution of Dignity with my professors. And we were passing exams, doing our seminars on the middle of the protest and on the central square of the city. Even then, we were trying to combine education and expression of our civic position. And when I became a lecturer myself, so the protest is important reason to miss a class for my students. They often protest against certain laws or something like that. But nevertheless, despite that there is so much discomfort in the city, the food is always gorgeous here. And it's affordable. The service, we have such a high quality of service and high standards. And digital services and digital governance work amazing. I can register my NGO via my smartphone, pay my taxes in such a user-friendly way. I can even get married via mobile application. Like, not get married, but establish everything. And actually, digital governance was very nice reform to reduce the corruption because you are not interacting with the people. There is no chance to bribe. And as so much services are digital, that it reduces the corruption. So I really like this digital period of our life. So Kyiv, you always feel the pressure of totalitarian past here and oppression. And you always feel this vital energy of post-colonial transformation. There is comfort and rest here, and you can have a joy, but not much to stop being challenged as a citizen. So I just fascinated that during the worst days of the war, coffee is still brilliant and delicious here.
That's amazing. I'm also really fascinated by the idea of digital governance. This is something I think the U.S. could learn a lot from because we're very bad at that. And, you know, we have all kinds of arguments going on in this country about just how to do voting because people don't agree on, you know, how you know, people are afraid, for example, of setting up digital voting structures and that kind of thing. But you point out, you know, it takes the corruption out of it, if you can take the people out of it, in a sense. So that's a very interesting observation. You know, if you think about the last year or so, I mean, you know, this is a good example. There's been a need for a large amount of innovation and adaptation among people in Ukraine. I wonder if you could talk about some of the changes you've had to make in your life and also some of the mistakes that you've made and maybe others have made in dealing with the situation that you're coping with. And how you think those errors have influenced your life. I mean, it would be hard not to make mistakes in a situation like this, but I think it's interesting to think about and learn from what that is.
Yes, it's a brilliant question. I'll also highlight that Ukraine is already cooperating with Estonia and Latvia on sharing this experience of digital governments and with US as well. So we're on the process of implementing stuff like that in other countries. It's very hard to explain such complex experience as full-scale invasion because, first of all, it's a huge existential crisis. It's constant physical danger, and also it's a crisis of resources and tools, and you feel that simultaneously. So it feels like you reinvent your whole life. Like your body feels different. You no longer have old dreams or purposes. Professional identity is another, relationship, core beliefs. And it's also the biggest intellectual challenge as you have to learn to do new things every day, work with difficult emotions, and update your worldview. So it seems to be a very chaotic and energy-consuming process, and you are not always have a resource to reflect. I am sure that the war will be over, but even then, I'll keep comprehending that experience and myself and understanding what I have done. But for now, the most important thing that I learned and changed, it was during the first day of the war. I was not acting on what I was feeling, but I was always trying to build a strategy to think about my actions on what I want to achieve. It was so scary. The body was reacting in such strong way, and you physically want to run, but it's so important during the war to control and your emotions and have emotional intelligence, because if you are not able, you will be killed. You won't be able to build a resistance. So it's the first rule. And first adaptation, not act on what you feel, but act on what you want to achieve. Another thing is we completely rely on each other. I have never relied so much on people before in my life. Even when I was poor and we have to collaborate with huge amount of relatives and rely on each other, it's not comparable. We collaborate much, much, much more, because as a person, you might not have a solution or a resource, but your community might. And you cannot be ready for multiple things. And I promise you, the solutions that work today won't work tomorrow. So we got back to this old rule that the community that stick together will still survive. And people are most important, and it's a key. And it's very important that the more self-reflecting your community is, and the more ecological communication is, the more chances to survive you have. So people and the quality of communication, like, it's everything. It's very surprising how in a huge city, a very individualistic period of our time, we can such rely on each other. So it's a general rule, but also we had tools. When we had an issue, for each issue, we started building completely decentralized, not hierarchical, flexible, and not registered networks. So we have a request. My friend is on the front line, on the harshest place of the front line, and they need a drone. And my friend in Norway, she has a drone. There is no logistic at all. There is huge queues on the borders. But because you have friends in different European countries, you can easily build a network. Like, in 5 hours, you build a network of people who will bring this drone to you and other people who will bring that directly on the front line. And once you use this network, you're never getting back to that, because there is next task, like buy bulletproof vest in China and pay in that in cryptocurrency. I had never experienced working with a cryptocurrency, but my husband knew how to do that, and we can build another network, and so on and so on and so on. And it's building these networks, it's the thing we advanced during the war. I highly recommend all works of Katerina Zarembo, Oksana Hus, and Oleksandra Kyodel. They are Ukrainian researchers who are providing their research in different world universities, and they write everything in English because they clearly stated unique features of Ukrainian civil society. It's decentralized, not hierarchical, flexible, and consists of not registered professional artistic networks. So for multiple researchers, it's so hard to research Ukrainian civic society because they do not know the language, and they do not have do not have an access to not registered communities, and they are doing all this work. So it's very fascinating, but it's pretty logical because often we as a nation didn't have a state, or the ruler of the state was set by another country, like in Soviet Ukraine. So people had to be very self-organized and do huge amount of work instead of state, as a state didn't represent them. So it's very challenging position for an individual, as I have to work, earn money, do work instead of state, care about many things that are not important for a state, resist to multiple imperialistic policies. So it's so much fun. You're constantly feeling exhausted but alive here. But probably that's why the coffee is gorgeous. There is always compensation for something like that.
Yeah. I'm curious. It sounds like what you're saying in a sense is that the experience under Soviet rule in a way almost prepared you for the invasion, because you had to have these informal networks in order to deal with Soviet rule. That's rather ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I never would have thought of that.
Yeah, Ukraine has a very long history of civic engagement and also very long history of anti-imperialism, because Hungary had imperial ambitions on Ukraine and the Bliza, we resisted. Austria had imperial ambitions on Ukraine, we resisted. Germany had imperial ambitions, we resisted. During First World War, there were 9 armies, they were fighting in Ukraine. Second World War, we get rid of. So I clearly remembered how our narrative is changed about a great terror or Holodomor, because often failures of Ukrainian state was explained that during the terror famine, peasants were killed and intelligentsia was killed. So there was no one to keep doing the work actively. But during this full-scale invasion, the narrative changed. Like, we started recognizing ourselves as a nation that was not broken down by the famine. So it's obvious that we won't be broken but by this full-scale invasion as well. So it's multi-central, and it's not about Russian imperialism, but also other kinds of imperialism as well. So for our culture, literature, music, paintings, we just feel so sensitive toward imperialism because we had it so much, and we are not struggling for democracy as just very specific kind of political regime. We're just struggling for freedom as an existential category. It's so important for us because we're just always dealing with bad guys.
Yeah, it's actually something also I think Americans don't understand very well. It's different to sort of talk about freedom as a sort of an abstraction and a way of life. It's different to talk about your existential reality, and you know, just the freedom to exist is a very different kind of freedom that you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. I'm so shocked to experience that I am targeted, that someone believe I'm fake, my state is fake, my language doesn't exist, that I have never had, like my parents did not speak Ukrainian or their grandparents. It's so awkward. It's so awkward just not to be safe, to be yourself. And even when I was going to Canada for a conference, I was stalked by a Russian guy in the airport who saw my Ukrainian passport. It's bizarre.
Wow. He followed you around?
Yeah. He was threatening me. And it's so bizarre because for me, as a young person that was born in independent states, this idea is too crazy to be real, that someone want to target you because you're Ukrainian. Oh my gosh, like, what's wrong?
Yeah. Why should it matter to him that you're Ukrainian or anything else? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. Let's talk a little bit about your work. You've been involved in efforts to kind of keep the academic world going, you know, in the middle of the situation, which I think is, you know, one of the things that people often don't think about is all the things that collapse when a country is invaded. And of course, the academic world collapses. It's hard to keep it operating. How do you keep the universities going? And so I was wondering if you could talk about the types of things that you've been doing, like this translation series that we're both involved with at Academic Studies Press, or really anything else. You know, why did you decide to develop these projects in the middle of the war, and what kinds of things have you been doing?
Yeah, that's a very good question. During the first day of the war, I just completely lost my professional identity, and I thought I would never work as a scholar. And also, I felt that it's so pointless. How can you analyze literary texts when you are attacked by missiles, and how it will protect you, change this world? So it's a huge existential crisis of the purpose. But then my colleagues who were in a safer position abroad, they just pushed me to write something, to take part in the conference, and then we get back to teaching on the second months of the war, and I had no idea how to do that. Like, part of my students are under occupation or something like that. Some of them lost homes, their parents. It's bizarre. But in a few months, I adapted. And right now, I realize that despite the full-scale invasion, all democratic institutions are functioning in Ukraine in a different way, but it's very surprising. It's also the thing not all people understand, that all administrations are working, schools, kindergartens, universities, but definitely everything changed. So we're brainstorming, developing different strategies, and also pay a lot of attention to mental health, and we are caring of our students, because it's also our responsibility of teachers to make sure they eat, they have a place to stay, their family have money. So we're checking this as well. And if someone of our students needs something, we just fundraise and deliver and sticking together. And I find myself in a very unusual position as a scholar, because the circumstances allow me only to document research a bit, but also experience war. And I feel that I'm object and a subject of my research, and it's a bit challenging, but also very stimulating intellectually. And of course, its features of this war are also highly game-changing. Of course, it's not the first war in the history of Europe. Nevertheless, it's first war in Europe in the global and digital era. And that impact literature and literary criticism. And I am first who can reflect on that. Like, Ukrainian writers do not have physical distance from the war. And we also do not have time distance. We document, research, make and share literary works about ongoing events almost in real time. And it's also changed means and roles of literature. We perceive the literature as a document, and literature as a communication and a coping strategy. Also, we observe the highest rate of mixing different genres and applying various different digital tools for narrations and storytelling. And as a scholar, I experience the lack of theories and approaches which I need now, and the time when you cannot relate on libraries and cannot access academic infrastructure, the importance of critical thinking, work ethic, and ability to think and work independently as high as never. And it's just changed the whole nature of academic work you are doing. And also what I noticed that the category of readers dramatically changed. Readers, they consume fiction and they know that, for example, readers that consume fiction or fiction about current war in Ukraine, they completely understand that these fictional characters and events are real, and that research objects that they are real, and all objects of my research are alive. Some of them just have lost their family members, or they are at risk of being killed. And it's completely changed the category of reader in the history of literature. And readers are so involved, they have never been so involved. And they also might share the trauma we are talking and discussing. And if a lot of readers, they are joining the resistance. And it's very huge responsibility of readers and consumers, the content about Ukraine. How should they react? How they should comprehend fiction about real crime that are happening right now? And that's all the stuff we talk and describe, it's also challenging understanding of other people, of security and humanity. And many readers became, or scholars, they became advocates, volunteers. So can we talk about agency of readers or agency of scholars? Because we often talk about agency of civil society members. It's new categories in literary studies. And we definitely have to recalibrate the category of objectivity and subjectivity. We all, while we are doing with the research, we all experience emotions. We all consume different violent content, graphic content. We're all engaged and we all have to develop our coping strategy. And it's just fascinating how everything changed, how perception of literature changed during the war. So when I describe new purposes of literature, and when I also understood that it's communication, because not all people knew who we are, like the first day of the war, my district is bombarded and I'm talking with a journalist. And he is struggling with understanding what is difference is between Russians and Ukrainians and why even they attacked us. And this person didn't know about the war in 2014. And their literature and research is also communications. And so everything was changed. And I am lucky to have this privilege to have education, to comprehend, reflect, and it also helps me to build more effective coping strategy for me as an individual.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Olly.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, is very important about this is how, despite our world of being so interconnected, how little we often know of other places. You know, that you said this guy didn't know anything about, you know, the war for you has actually been much longer than just a year, because this really did start in 2014. And yet people in other places are pretty unaware of that. It reminded me of something you, a while back, you posted something about the literature in Russia and the way that it represents, like, the United States and other places. And I was not knowing anything about this because I don't read Russian and, you know, I wouldn't see it in translation. I was really sort of shocked. Could you talk a little bit about some of that literature?
Yeah, I did a research back in 2019 about Russian fiction and how contemporary Russian fiction represent current war. And the main feature was that in Russian language, the fiction about contemporary Russian-Ukrainian war appeared earlier than war. In 2009, 2010, 2011, appeared huge amount of novels about nearest future when Russia invaded Crimea and also in occupying Donetsk and Luhansk district. And the motivation was the following: NATO and United States are provoking the Third World War and doing that on the territory of Ukraine, and Russia as a great power trying to rescue Russian-speaking population and restore peace and nice, prosperous life. And that's why they are attacking Ukraine and annexing Crimea. And if we compare with that with political statements, yeah, this political statement was proclaimed in 2006 and something like that. And also, if there is a lot of scholars who are working in prominent universities who are also trying to convince that there is civil war in Ukraine and that's a NATO or United States fault that the war started. So what this war learned me that literature is not just a literature. Literature can be art, can be communication strategy, coping strategy, and propaganda as well. So they need to think critically higher than ever. And it's our work as a scholars, not only to do our analysis, but also communicate with a broader audience to give them a tool so they will be able to distinguish certain things, and that will enlarge our chances for peace and security, because it's a digital age. And to occupy a country, you sometimes do not need a border. You can occupy the mind, said the idea. And that's the reason why there was no reactions in 2014, because Russian voice was so prominent and so strong that it was, and the so much versions why the thing happened, that it was too challenging. And also there is a crisis of expertise. I was so shocked that sometimes people saying they are experts when they are not knowing the language and can't work with primary sources. I thought that cannot happen in United States or in Europe. Like, no, that can happen. So,
it's all over. All you have to do is go look at Twitter and you will see thousands of people who are experts on everything, most of whom know nothing about anything they're experts on. You know, it's astonishing. This is actually a problem in the U.S. There has been in the last few decades, and it's kind of runs through American history, but there's been a really overt attack on the idea of expertise, that there are people who actually have knowledge that you can't get from just Googling it. And, you know, you hear people all the time, you know, here saying, oh, I'm going to research this on the internet. You're not doing research. You're looking shit up on the internet. That's what you're doing. But the mindset, they believe that because they can Google something, they can somehow deeply understand things. And I think this is where, you know, in, like in the situation in Ukraine, I think the role of academics is so important, because a surface level understanding of what's happening there is not what we need. We need a deep expert understanding, and that involves experience, but also, you know, working through the literature, working through the different ways that propaganda gets used, and which I think is, it's really important. Your role, people like what you're doing, is very important in what's happening there, particularly when you look at like the U.S., where a lot of people, you know, we've got people in the U.S. are saying, oh, it's ridiculous, we shouldn't be supporting Ukraine. And it's like, well, you don't understand what's happening there. You know, it astonishes me. I get a bit irritated about it. But I think, you know, this is why, one of the reasons why the, keeping the academic world going is, it matters, even in the middle of a war.
Yeah, it's painful, but we always face here multiple challenges first, right? Like Russian disinformation, this sophisticated Russian disinformation, the sophisticated hybrid wars. And now we push the world to change the legislation, laws, and to find other solutions in order to establish another better global peace and security model. And like, we would love to share this experience, because here we have so much coping strategies and strategies of resilience, and the world will keep being a tough place. So it will be nice to incorporate the best stuff we have here to make our world like safer. And just very important to exchange the experience. And also with our iconic poet Taras Shevchenko warned us, learn what others are doing and share your experience. That is the way to success. And it's very old canonical Ukrainian mantra. So indeed, we also as a scholars we'll do better job if we also communicate in an ecological way and cooperate in a non-hierarchical and practical way.
Yeah, I think, you know, the world needs to learn from what's happening in Ukraine right now. And the voices of people there need to come out so people can learn from this. So, you know, I sort of chuckled as I was saying that, because, you know, in the back of my mind, it arose, well, you would have thought we would have learned this by now, having gone through two world wars and all the other wars that we've gone through, but we don't seem to have learned. And so, you know, I think it's really important for these voices to come out and hopefully get people to realize what's actually happening.
Yeah, and I also really like that the podcast is called How to Be Wrong. Another thing, I'm also very ready to be open when I am wrong and to recognize all mistakes we did, we keep doing, because only being very open on what you just have done wrong, you can move forward. Ukraine is not a perfect country, and we're not always dealing with everything in a nice and productive way. We have a huge amount of problems as well. So I just don't want people percept us like perfect and very nice people. Like we're just people like everyone else. But indeed, very bad situation motivate you to be a better version of yourself and be open on your mistakes will make your chances to survive higher and higher. So that's very practical motivation to admit.
Well, I think that brings me to the next question I wanted to explore a bit is, you know, when you think, we've talked a bit about emotion, and obviously anger has to have been a major, and it's still got to be a constant emotion that you're, you know, dealing with. But I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about anger, but also the idea of humility in the face of the invasion. And as a scholar, maybe a bit about intellectual or epistemological humility in relation to the experience of war. I'm wondering, as a scholar, you know, how do you think the war has changed your thinking about the work and the role of academics? We've touched on that a little bit. I wonder if you go in a little bit more depth on that.
Yeah, anger is a very common emotion. I admit that. And also I think it's legit. And we have a right to be angry. And this emotion has its functions. Anger as in any strong emotions help us to remember certain things and prevent them from happening. Also that I believe that's true, that the anger of Ukrainian society may increase if international community won't sincerely collaborate on establishing new global security format, new laws to punish all these war criminals and really change something. And I think it's also normal and it's also legit because people are angry when there is a huge amount of injustice. And yeah, to make our world more prosperous and to have well-being, we have to build as fair and as justice model as we can. So it's also legit. I really like the book, The Geopolitics of Emotions, how cultures of fear, humiliation, and hope are reshaping the world. The author is Dominic Moisi. He's Italian scholar, so I might mispronounce his name. but I'm accurate with the title of the book. I have Ukrainian translation here. And personally, I love emotion of anger because it feels much better than grief, despair, and fear. And anger helped me to work longer hours. And I will repeat myself. If you cannot rule your emotions, it's stupid to ignore or to pretend you don't have them. If you can rule your emotions on the war, you are dead and you won't build a resistance strategy. So I experience more emotions because of the war. I work more with them and I am very open about their role, but I do not act upon them. I act upon things I dream to have. And it's our coping strategy because each time we are figuring out about new Russian crimes, we establish more fundraisers to help families or to change. And we direct our anger to actions that are constructive. We won't avoid emotions, but we can transfer them in a more constructive way. Each time we were experiencing massive bombardments of Kyiv, we were donating all money we were having for drones and other weapons that can protect us. And it was each time, each time we're experiencing new crisis, that means you have to find one more freelance job, get your payment and spend it and donate it to the initiative you trust. And that felt good, that helped you to deal with these emotions. I believe it's so important for adult people and adult societies acknowledge and rule your emotions and to be very constructive with them. And also it's so important to build right memory politics, because if we won't do that, we will have so much problems. Like, I was very fascinated by the thing, like my great grandpa, his grave is in Berlin suburbs because he was liberating Europe from a Nazi regime. And when I started doing my history courses in university, I explored that amount of Ukrainians in Soviet army was huge. Almost each third or fourth general was Ukrainian origin, and the amount of Ukrainian soldiers was huge. But in 10 years, knowing that, not having a grave of my great-grandfather in Berlin, in the 10 years, my classmate and close friend Maria Kovalchuk, she also started doing PhD in Munich University, and she did a research about German memory politics. So she read all school books that was written in German language to see how Ukrainians are represented in the Second World War. And there were zero mentions about Ukraine. So imagine how kids and young generation, they will grow up, and they will grow up with the thought that Russia liberated the whole world from Nazi regime, and that the own them. And Russia also pays reparation, or Germany paid reparation only to Russia, not to other countries. And that's not a right memory politics. And on this myth that Russia is a great power that liberated the world from the Nazi, which not such a true, because other countries were involved, Belarusian troops, Belarusian people, the help of United States, Europe, and so on. It was very important. So it's just a myth. But when a myth became a political tool and memory politics is so dangerous and it's so hard to reshape it, and that's where the scholars have to work harder and harder. And we have to understand how our scholarly work affect different areas and be very responsible on narratives, on our quality of our research, and to be very honest about our positionality and standards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, you know, struck about as you're talking about how Ukrainians responded, and, you know, with the theme of this podcast, how to be wrong, it just struck me how utterly wrong Putin got things. He didn't understand Ukrainian culture at all. And that's a huge mistake, you know, aside from the invasion just being a mistake. But the arrogance and the unwillingness to understand another place led him down a path that basically is bound to fail and doesn't make any sense. And, you know, it's really striking. It's kind of the, you know, what we've seen this over and over with, you know, various societies in the world that attack another society. And often one of their big mistakes is the failure to understand the culture of the society they're attacking. I mean, this happened when Japan attacked the United States in 1941, there had been a, you know, significant pacifist movement in the United States, and the Japanese thought that the U.S. would just basically say, oh, okay, we'll leave you alone. But they didn't really understand that attacking American soil would completely change the way people looked at things, because they didn't understand the culture. And, you know, it's the same kind of thing. You just, Putin doesn't, I'm sure he didn't care either, but you know, he has made an enormous mistake. It's striking to look at basically everything he's tried to do has backfired. You know, the goal of trying to split up NATO, well, it's stronger than ever. You know, it's just one thing after another when you look at it. And it's basically a product of arrogance that led to that.
Yeah, you probably know this law from the sociology that the most loud voice, it's not the most representative voice. But these colonial politics are very effective, and probably not. People also have to understand that we are dealing with internal decolonization and de-imperialization as well. And I am dealing with that personally. When I was a kid, I came to Kyiv in my fifth grade, and I was speaking Ukrainian because I was born in Ukraine. I never heard Russian before because I have never had a TV in my childhood because we were a poor family. So we came to Kyiv, and I went to school, and then I get back home and ask my mom, like, Mom, why kids are speaking such a strange Ukrainian? And my mom told me, that's Russian. Like, what is that? I was so shocked that kids are speaking in a school in Russian, and as they was making laugh for me because I was speaking Ukrainian, they immediately perceived me as completely not cool person, peasant, stupid, not cool. And I believe that it's true. When I was a kid, I thought I'm not cool. And then I started talking Russian, and I was so ashamed. Like, I felt I betrayed myself because I just gave up something authentic in order to be cool. And I was so ashamed of my parents, of my culture. And when I were getting back home and I was talking by phone with my classmates, I was again ashamed that I'm speaking Russian because my parents saw that I betrayed something authentic. And then I became popular. I got a lot of friends because I was not having friends for a few years in school because of my native language. And then I entered university, and it was Kyiv-Mohyla University, which like was very Ukrainian. People were speaking Ukrainian there, and they were very nice in teaching Ukrainian literature, history, and so on. And then I was like 17 or 18 when I started studying history, and I realized that for the last 300 years, Ukrainian language was constantly forbidden, that people were killed because of speaking Ukrainian. And the only way to use Ukrainian was to sing silly songs about the village. And that's it. No children books, no science in Ukrainian. And it was entertainment industry was working to picture Ukrainians as simple, stupid villagers that always fighting with each other, and they are poor because they are stupid, and they are stupid because they are poor, and nothing can be done. And only then I realized that it's not me who is not cool, it's just imperial policies and the result of imperial policies for being like ashamed of who you are. That's the case, it's not me, it's just imperialism. And it was a huge realization for me. And only when the war started in 2014, I realized that we are not stupid, but intelligentsia was killed. The brain of the nations was killed. That's why there is a lack of smart people here. And we are not poor because we are stupid. That for centuries, empire was taking our land, material goods, non-material goods, intellectual property. Like, they were pretending that Degas was painting Russian dancers while it was Ukrainian dancers. And it was huge scandal with museums who were not willing to change the title and something like that. So we as a society also dealing with internal colonization and rethinking ourselves. And if when I was a kid, it was very shameful to speak Ukrainian, after 24, after Orange Revolution, it wasn't like that. And after Revolution of Dignity, speaking Ukrainian meant that you're intelligentsia, that you're smart, that you're critical. So like, with all this experience, you're completely understanding how everything is unset. And we as a human are always searching for a best coping strategies and strategies to survive, and that's it.
Yeah, the discussion of language in particular reminds me a great deal of what Native Americans have faced, where the U.S. government, you know, in schools and things prohibited Native Americans from speaking their own language. It's a form of dominance that, you know, a kind of an imperialism that basically rips people of their own culture. And, you know, and that's, of course, exactly what Russia's trying to do yet again. So this has been a really powerful conversation. I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to add that we haven't covered about your situation or about the topic of how to be wrong. I think our listeners are going to learn a great deal from this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Probably I would like just to highlight that Ukraine might look very inspirational, but we do not have to romanticize or to idealize things, because like being a kid of famine survivors who build successful business, it on the same time, it means having great example of strengths, but also intergenerational trauma. Pluses and minuses in the same time. And being Ukrainian also means being ashamed of who you are, oppressed, overlooked, but also it means positive things like being anti-imperial, sensitive to injustice, have this post-colonial transformative power. And also our success in resistance means a lot of killed Ukrainians who were brilliant, who were young, who were talented. And we are missing that so much. I just physically can feel how many work I have, more and more work per one person. And it's devastating to miss all those people. And I feel like I am between the hell and civilized world. And both of these realities are real and they are legit for me. And that's probably shaped a lot of things. And I would also like to remind that we can't ignore that the world is a very bad place, but it's also true that there is good things, and it always be like that. It might sound frightening, but the good thing is that we can contribute to making certain tendencies stronger. So,
well, Maria, I find your optimism to be just both inspirational and astonishing. And I have really enjoyed our conversation. I think, as I said, I think our listeners are going to learn a lot, and not just about the situation in Ukraine, but just about life, which, you know, that's ultimately what all of this is about. So I thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I want to mention that your work embracing uncertainty is also became our mantra, because all that we do, we embrace uncertainty, and we're looking so much the Ukrainian translation of your work. And I'm also really grateful for this time and this invitation, because it's just an opportunity for me to make a pause and to reflect a bit. And I'm sure that I was wrong somewhere, and it's completely okay.
Yes, it is okay to be wrong. That is, I think, an important thing. Well, I don't think it's okay to be wrong in the way that Putin is wrong, but in our daily lives, I think it is okay. And I think, you know, we need to learn from those things. And so thank you. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for me as well.